Travis Smiley, and I am thrilled to have you hanging out with us today in this hour of our program. I've been looking forward to this hour. And in this hour, a conversation for the hour with outgoing Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, who I hope will take some time to look back at her 8-year run as the chief prosecutor of America's second largest county, the first black woman elected to the powerful post. She has opted not to seek re-election and has acknowledged criticism for the handling of certain cases, like the one against actor Jussie Smollett. But Cook County State's Attorney is a long way from Chicago's Cabrini Green Housing Project. You might know that from the Good Times TV series if you're not from Chicago, but there are so many accomplishments to acknowledge in this hour as well, and we'll do all of that now that I am pleased to be joined by the present, but soon to be former, Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox. How are you today?
I'm good, Travis. What an honor to be with you this afternoon.
No, it's an honor to have you on. Thank you for the hour. I know how busy your schedule is, and I'm just thrilled that we have these 60 minutes or a little bit less now. We'll make the most of it to talk to you. So thank you for just putting us on your docket. I know all kinds of folk are asking you for conversations, and I just feel very humbled that you thought enough of us to put us on your schedule. So thank you for that, Kim, to begin with. Let me start with this. So why the decision not to run again?
Yeah, so when I ran in 2016, I had a mission. I wanted to transform our criminal justice system here in Cook County that had a long and perilous legacy of police misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct, a swelling jail population, ongoing violence in communities like the one that I grew up in. And so I knew that there were things that I wanted to do, but I also knew, just as importantly, that I didn't want to be a career politician. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that I was going to have some self-imposed term limits as a mom who's the last of my children are graduating from high school this year as well. Mm-hmm. I knew that this was a finite job, and so I needed to do as much as I can while I had it, but that I would not be doing this for the rest of my career.
Yeah, so you know I'm pulling and praying for you, because I know you got them girls about to go off to college, so you're going to be you about to be in a minute with two or three of them in school at the same time. So you're on my prayer list, Kim Fox. Yeah, four of them. Yeah, you're on my prayer list.
In college.
Yeah, that's crazy. Let me follow you. I'm going to follow you the whole hour anyway. That is a blessing. I was just in a conversation the other day with somebody about this. I'm one of 10 kids. And I am the first person in the history of my family on either side, my mother or my father's side, the first one to go to college. So I broke through that barrier first. But so many of my younger brothers and sisters followed my lead and went to college. Some of them, most of them, I paid for. The one that went to Hampton and the one that went to Morehouse, I helped to get them through. And I nothing I've done in my life has made me prouder than to help my siblings get their own college degrees. And literally yesterday, I broke down in tears just yesterday when I received in the mail an invitation from my niece, who's now graduating from college. And I got a few nieces and nephews who are graduating over the next couple of years. The point is that I'm the one person who went first. And that one person has now changed the trajectory of my own family. So I know that education can be a great equalizer. And so here you are now. We'll talk about Cabrini in a moment, but it must be a beautiful thing to just know that you got four babies and they're going to go off to college as well. That story is that. I mean, I got goosebumps right now, Kim.
Absolutely. Listen, my mom was a high school dropout. I was born 2 months before she was supposed to graduate from high school, and I was her second child. And so I have been able to, in this generation, go to college, go to law school, ascend to this work. And now my own children, my oldest is a junior in college, and I said my youngest will be graduating this year. I took guardianship of a set of sisters while doing this work quietly. People didn't know. That I was raising four teenage girls in this landscape and trying to get them through. And my youngest is committing to Clark Atlanta. She wants the HBCU experience. I got a kid at Arizona State, another one who's looking to travel internationally. Just the fact that those possibilities exist, that they can dream of anything that they want to do while their grandmother made so much sacrifice for me, It is a privilege.
Yeah. No, it's an amazing story. It is an amazing story. Just getting started in this hour with Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox. A lot to cover in this conversation. I'm thinking about Cabrini and her own personal journey. I'm thinking about some of the cases, national cases, of course, that she has overseen during her eight-year tenure. I'm thinking of her being the first black woman there. I said on this program yesterday that you think of all these black women now who are in these major positions when it comes to making these kinds of decisions about, frankly, the future of our country. I'm thinking of Fani Willis in Georgia. I'm thinking of Letitia James in New York. I'm thinking of Kim Fox in Chicago and what it means for so many of these persons to be the first black women to inhabit these positions and these roles and what comes along with that. A lot to talk about with Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, our guest in this hour on Tavis Smart.
Hope, agency, dignity. This is Tavis Smiley.
Can you dig it?
Come on!
Ready to re-examine your assumptions and expand your inventory of ideas? More of Tavis Smiley coming your way right now.
More of Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox coming your way right about now. We've already mentioned it a couple times, Kim Fox, so let me just go there first. Tell me about growing up in Cabrini. I mentioned many people know, folk in Chicago, of course, know all about it. Folk outside of Chicago and around the world know about it from good times. But tell me about growing up in Cabrini.
Man, yeah, I grew up at 624 West Division in the heart of Cabrini, what we would call the White Projects. Which are right across the way from the red ones, to denote the color of the bricks. Raised by my mom, who was a teenager, two babies by the time she was 18, and my grandmother, who was, you know, a primitive Baptist church-going, praying grandmother who took care of my mom and her kids and her four other children and their kids. A community that, you know, certainly was ravaged by violence, that was impoverished, that was neglected by the rest of the city, but had some of the hardest working, loving, dedicated people I'd ever met. We talk about the gig economy. There was a gig economy, you know, when I was growing up, who sold candy on the fifth floor, my grandmother who sold Avon, folks who sold icy cups, people who drove folks to the grocery store. I mean, I grew up with a gig economy, with a hustle economy, and just people who looked after one another when the systems didn't look after us. And so I look back at my time in Cabrini with such fondness. Is why I talk about everywhere I go, because people have expectations for what people in Cabrini can do.
Yeah.
And the systems have set those expectations up. And so it's important for me in my story to talk about what is possible for those kids who grew up in that environment.
How did you process, how did you navigate your way through, if I can put it this way, the soft bigotry of those low expectations?
You know, I also have to, like, level set. It wasn't even just that I was talented, right? So I want to tell people I am not exceptional in what Cabrini could produce. We had opportunity, right? So we moved from Cabrini when I was in third grade to Lincoln Park, which was 1 mile north in one of the most affluent neighborhoods in the city. Mm-hmm. And we were poor. We couldn't afford to live in Lincoln Park. We just were in Lincoln Park. I moved every year from third grade until I graduated from high school with a point of homelessness my junior year. And it was so we could go to the premier magnet school, LaSalle Language Academy, that taught French, German, Italian, Spanish from kindergarten on up. That had trips to the Art Institute. We had annual trips to Paris, Barcelona, to Madrid. That public education, a mile from where I was in Cabrini. And so when I got there, it was very much, and I remember being acutely aware that, you know, they were wondering, could I read at the same level? Now, these were kids who were taking Spanish from kindergarten. I'm now in third grade. And them saying, well, you have to catch up. It might be difficult for you. And my mother, who was just old enough to get us there, was like, absolutely not. You will not have different expectations for my child. And it was, I was very keenly aware because I was there and you could see it. And I'd also be back at my grandmother's in Cabrini. And I knew that they weren't smarter than me. that they weren't better. And it made me, however, hyper ambitious to prove that it didn't matter where I came from. I was a gifted child. And we were going to, I was going to outperform the expectations they had for me. Yeah. And that early indoctrination to having to perform to those low expectations helped me throughout, you know, my childhood, college, and even the job that I have today.
Yeah. I'm going to talk to my board out right quick, Kim. Your phone is starting to wobble on me, and this conversation is too important and being heard by too many people across the country for us not to hear everything that Kim Fox is saying. In case you've just tuned in, our guest in this hour, for the hour, is soon to be former Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, joining us live from Chicago. And this is live radio, and so sometimes these phones decide to act up at the wrong time, and I don't want to spend the rest of the hour with you struggling to hear what she has to say. And for that matter, I got headphones on, and I'm struggling to hear certain parts, and I don't want that to be the case. So let's get that solved right quick. But it's important to have her on for a number of reasons. One, as I intimated earlier, her backstory that you've heard just a bit of right now, coming from Cabrini Green, those housing projects in Chicago, is quite a tale, and it reminds us of what we are capable of, what we can do when we have opportunity. Speaking of Chicago, I quote him all the time. Jesse Jackson told me years ago, Jackie Robinson wasn't the first brother who could play baseball with the white boys. He was the first one who they gave the opportunity to play baseball with the white guys. And so opportunity makes a difference. And so you hear Kim Fox telling us that she had some opportunity. It's not just that she's gifted or talented. Clearly she is. But it makes a difference when you get an opportunity to prove your talents, to prove your skill, to prove your worth. And so I wanted to have her on for that reason, but also because she accomplished a great deal over this 8-year period. We just had on this program, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, Chesa Boudin, out of San Francisco, who was elected, as Kim Fox was and others, during this era when we thought, or at least acted like, we wanted a bunch of progressive DAs. And then when they got in, we started trying to pull some of them out. They successfully recalled Mr. Boudin in San Francisco. There's a documentary out now called Beyond Bars about his story, so we had him on. But Kim, again, one of those progressive DAs. So a lot to talk about. I think I got her back on the line now. Kim, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now, as they say?
I can hear you. I hope you can hear me. I apologize.
No. It's okay. I want to make sure that, as I said a moment ago, that you're being heard nationally, and I want to make sure that everybody gets the chance to understand and hear your story as we move through this hour. And I don't want you to be garbled the way that you were getting for a second there. That said, we did hear what you said. I want to just kind of continue this line of this questioning, if I can. Now I sound like an attorney, right? This line of questioning that didn't come out the way I wanted to. You're not on the witness stand, as you well know. But it means something for me to hear you tell the story of what happens when you are afforded opportunity. And I think about all those kids in Chicago, many of whom are still fighting, Chicago and beyond, who are still fighting for that kind of opportunity. But I'm also thinking about the ways in which we were talking about the expectations or low expectations that people have in Chicago of folk that come out of Cabrini. The same could be said of the way that we view in the mainstream media the city of Chicago. We see Chicago as a great city in many respects, but it's always that city that they use as Exhibit A, they being the other side. When they talk about crime, when they talk about guns, I mean, I'm headed there this summer, as many of us will be, for the Democratic Convention. But talk to me about the way your home city is viewed in the national media oftentimes.
Well, look, we have a reputation for gun violence in this city. A reputation that has been almost the entirety of my life. In fact, even before I was born, people would talk about, they'd go overseas and they'd talk about Chicago, and people would say, bang, bang, talking about Al Capone.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had a history in Chicago, and the truth of the matter is an unrelenting assault of gun violence the entirety of my life. But I think the bigger story is, like I talk about the complexity of what it's like to live in Cabrini and violence, is we also have a history of redlining, a history of disinvestment. You know, when Martin Luther King came to Chicago in the 60s and talked about how it was one of the most racist cities mm-hmm. he'd ever been in.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't decouple the violence that I just described and the absolute disinvestment and structural racism that have created conditions in communities that are largely Black and brown and the violence that we see. And so it is a world-class city, let me say that. Mm-hmm. That's why we're hosting the DNC. We have, you know, amazing, you know, culture, architecture, food, people. But we have pockets in our city that have been neglected for decades that are dealing with violence, and our children are dealing with violence that we could solve for if mm-hmm. we actually cared and believed that those kids in those neighborhoods could grow up to be yeah. lawyers, doctors, social workers, teachers.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if I can get you to be to confess. You know, as I said earlier, you're not on the witness stand, but I do want a confession here. And the confession I'm yeah. looking for is for you to tell me, as Cook County State's Attorney for 8 years now, what has been the most stubborn problem, the most stubborn issue that you've had to confront?
I think the most stubborn issue is gun violence, but mm-hmm. how we solve for it. I think we have this notion of good guys, bad guys. I think we have this notion, and it's generally broken down by race. And as we try to solve for it, we keep doing the same things over and over again. Every beginning of the summer, we brace ourselves for summer violence. We put in policing strategies to deal with where outbreaks may go. But we don't invest in what we know prevents violence in the first place, which are things that are outside of the criminal justice system, which is education, a quality education for everybody, access to jobs for everybody, access to care. You know, we have kids who have classmates who've been murdered, and they have easier access to guns than they do to a guidance counselor or a trauma counselor. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's been the stubborn issue, is that none of this is new. When I was a high schooler in 1989, I lost a friend to gun violence. And that year we had almost 900 people murdered in the city of Chicago. The fact that we are now almost 35 years later and we are still battling these same issues is because we have ignored what we know will work, which is addressing the root causes of violence.
Mm-hmm. So that leads me then to this notion of what happens when we say, as a nation, in certainly major cities, that we want to try something different. And that thing that we tried that was different was electing progressive DAs. You were a part of that batch, a part of that group. There are others all across the country, your colleagues, you know them better than I do. But I mentioned moments ago, we had Chase Boudin on this program a few weeks ago talking about this new documentary about his interesting backstory called Beyond Bars. But they successfully recalled him in San Francisco. They've tried that a couple of times here in L.A., where I sit with George Gascon, who you know. So just talk to me about what I see, at least, as our sort of political schizophrenia, that we say we want progressive DAs. They get in, they start doing progressive stuff, and then we all start screaming.
I mean, but if the question is, who is the we,
yeah,
right?
Right.
So when I ran for re-election in 2020, it was coming off of the Jussie Smollett case that had generated editorials and papers for almost a year and was being used as a cudgel to get me out. Mm-hmm. And I had an opponent who spent $15 million against me, and I beat him by 20 points. Mm-hmm. And when we looked at the breakdown of where the support was coming from, the people most impacted by crime, violence, and our justice system overwhelmingly voted for me. Those folks who had a distance from it, so some of our suburban voters, our more affluent voters who wanted a more punitive approach, had a different vote. And so I think what you're seeing is not so much a schizophrenia for the electorate, is by the people who are most impacted by the system want something different. Mm-hmm. And those who have benefited from a system that was more punitive, those who have had a further reach from it, who have more political power oftentimes. In San Francisco, it was wealthy corporate, you know, tech bros who were financing that. The people who were directly impacted, we're still voting for a new way to go. Mm-hmm. And so I think within our own parties, we have a disconnect between those who are most harmed by the systems that we have in place, who are crying for something mm-hmm. different, and those who have power and influence who say that they don't want that. And they don't have to have They don't have to live that. Yeah. They don't have to live what those repercussions are.
I've got 2 minutes now. We'll continue when we come forward. Let me give you a chance to get started on this answer, and we'll see where we are in 2 minutes. Now that you've been on the inside for 8 years as one of the leaders of this system or inside the system, what now is your critique of the system?
The system.
I heard that chuckle. Go ahead.
The system is not equipped to hold itself accountable.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the biggest critique. That mm-hmm. the system with this much power, the power to deprive people of their freedoms and liberty, the power once in Illinois to take someone's life, is fallible. But it is not equipped to adjust for when it gets it wrong. The fact that we have vacated over 250 wrongful convictions just in the last 8 years, lead the country in vacating wrongful convictions. And these convictions have happened, many of them decades ago, with men and women sitting in prison in cages for years because, well, an appellate court said it was okay. Well, then a court above that said it was okay. And we sit and look at it, and it's so clearly wrong. If we weren't here, then what?
Yeah.
So it's a system that is fallible, that has no accountability built within it.
A quick follow-up in 30 seconds. We'll continue when we come forward. Am I naive to believe that the primary source of those wrongful convictions in Cook County is racism?
I think race absolutely has a role to play. When I look at the number of convictions we vacated, the overwhelming majority of the people whose convictions have been vacated have been black and brown. And by overwhelming majority, somewhere around 94%.
Yeah, I knew that was coming. Her name is Kim Fox. She is the outgoing Cook County State's Attorney. My name is Tavis Smiley. We'll continue our conversation when we come forward. Stay with us.
What's your quarrel with the world? You're listening to Tavis Smiley. Who do you trust to get at the truth?
Tavis Smiley. Smiley.
That's who. The conversation continues right now.
It does indeed with Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, who I am honored to have on this program, and just deeply grateful that she's given us an hour of her time. You mentioned Jussie Smollett earlier. Let me just ask a quick question about that before I move on to some other things I want to cover with you. What's always fascinating for me regarding the Jussie Smollett case is that to the point you made earlier, you stood for re-election thereafter and won, and didn't just win, but won handily in that race. But with all these months now in the rearview mirror, when you hear the name Jussie Smollett or you're asked about that case, you have what to say?
I always chuckle first.
I heard that too.
It's one of those habits as we talk about. Chicago is a city that has been reeling with violence for years. And part of what I ran on was focusing our attention on prosecuting violent crime and not using our limited resources to go after low-level petty offenses. And that's what happened in that case. And I find it fascinating in Chicago that it took up so much energy. People can disagree with whether they thought he should have had a stiffer penalty or not. Prosecutors throughout our history have had the opportunity to use their discretion to do just that. And we've spent more time over the course of the last 5 years talking about the one black man who did not go to prison for a nonviolent low-level offense than we have the hundreds of black men who have walked out of prison convicted of crimes that they didn't commit. And I don't think it's by accident that the conversations have revolved around Jussie and not these broader issues. I think it's actually quite deliberate. I don't mind saying that we handle Jussie's case in a way that we handle many other low-level nonviolent offenses. In fact, there have been studies done that show that we've sent far fewer people to prison for low-level nonviolent offenses, largely black and brown folk, during the course of this tenure. And so it has been, to me, an outsized distraction from the broader issues of criminal justice in Cook County, that if Jussie Smollett and not John Burge and the wrongful convictions of hundreds of black men for crimes that they didn't commit is the greatest criminal justice failure of the Cook County justice system, we got a real big problem on our hands.
You got dragged a lot. I don't need to tell you. You got the scars, I'm sure, to prove it. But you got dragged pretty aggressively and pretty viciously during that period. And yet, I often remind people, because I've been through this in my own career, that we are not human and divine. We're just human. And when you get dragged, you feel it. Tell me a bit more, if you can, and if you're willing to, personally, how you navigated that period of your life.
Thank you for first the recognition that I was a human going through that. It was very intense. That the noise around that case or the eruption happened at a time in my life where I lost a cousin, who was 19 years old, who was shot in the head. And there were reporters who showed up at the funeral trying to get a comment from me, about Jussie. There were rumors, because people it just didn't make sense. It wasn't even just that they didn't like what happened to Jussie, that there must have been something corrupt about me. And so I heard rumors about my daughters, were extras on the Empire set, that my brother, who, is a Juilliard-trained actor, must have been in a relationship with Jussie. So it was these rumors and innuendo and, like, legitimate media and tabloid media. I had, TMZ sitting outside my home one day. It was the wear and tear, not just on me, but my family. And the fear that my children had, that my then husband had, that my father had, that made me question, was what I doing worth the pain that was being inflicted on those around me? Now, again, I grew up in Cabrini with women who had endured quite a bit. And mm-hmm. So I'm built for this, but there is something to watch the people that you love, who had nothing to do with the decision, who don't do this work, who, want to quietly go to school and go to work, have to wear your decisions and the aftermath on them. And yeah. That was very, very difficult for me.
Were you ever concerned? We all know how it turned out, as I intimated a moment ago. Were you ever concerned that the voters in Cook County were going to punish you for that case?
No. What I knew was that the vitriol, the highest level of vitriol, wasn't coming from people who were impacted by the system, mm-hmm. and a lot of it wasn't even coming from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
The former president, got up on a mic in the heart of it and called me corrupt. Donald Trump and his acolytes, they took up all of this. When I would go out in the community, it was very heartening when people said, "Kim, we got you. Kim, we know what this is. Kim, we see this." Did I lose some support? Sure. Did I lose significant support? Not at all. And it was a testament to who gets to tell our stories and what's most important to the people who live here. Is it outside media sources? Is it fringe groups? Or the people who live here and see the work that we've done? I think the man who spent $15 million thinking that he could defeat me on the strength of Jussie Smollett has more questions to answer to why he thought that that would work and not connect to the people versus connecting to, political moneyed interests. And we demonstrated in that election that the people put me in this seat and wanted me to continue.
So I mentioned earlier, and I celebrated it when it happened, and I still celebrate the fact that you are the first black woman to leave the Cook County State Attorney's Office. That's a big deal for anybody, but particularly given what people think of folk coming out of Cabrini, as we established earlier in this conversation, it's an even bigger deal. That said, how do you process? I know how I process it, but that ain't the point. How do you process that we're in a moment now where there are some pretty powerful black women who are in these prosecutorial positions, whether it's Fonnie Willis in Fulton County, whether it's Letitia James in New York State, whether it's you in Cook County? This is a serious moment, is it not?
It is a serious moment. I want to celebrate the moment and also contextualize it,
sure.
Right? When I came into office in 2016, the Women's Donor Network had done a study out of 2,400 elected prosecutors in this country, less than 1% were women of color, mm-hmm. less than 1%. And so if we just took out the black women, we all fit on the same text chain, We had a group chat, and that is striking that we could all be on the same group chat. You know,
yeah.
And Eve, so those numbers began to swell. Like when I ran for office in 2016, I had the benefit of seeing Marilyn Mosby when she was the district attorney or the state's attorney in Baltimore in the wake of Freddie Gray. I had the benefit of seeing Kim Worthy out of Detroit. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those women set a stage for me. And I think with my election and the election of Sherry Boston and others, Rachel Rollins in Boston, Massachusetts, we saw more Black women ascend to these roles. Tish James, Fonnie Willis came post 2016. But those numbers, as they swell, they also have fallen. Marilyn Mosby is no longer the state's attorney in Baltimore. Kim Gardner, who was the first Black prosecuting attorney in St. Louis, was driven out of office. Rachel Rollins has been out of office. And so, you know, these gains that we have seen and these significant women who are carrying our democracy on their backs in the wake of what has been intimidation and hatred coming their way is a testament to what Black women do. But it does not come without cost. And, you know, the survival rate of Black women doing this work is not very high. And so I commend them. I think they are doing incredible work, but we have to make sure that we are supporting them.
You're listening to Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox on Tavis Smiley, and I'm glad about it.
Interrogating and unpacking.
That's what we do around here.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley. Smiley. Smart talk for curious people just like you.
Just like you.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Smiley. Tavis Smiley and Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox. Kim, given what you said moments ago, there are actually two things swirling in my head. I don't often do this, but let's just play Jeopardy, and I'll let you choose which one you want to address first. You can pick off the big board. I want to ask you, given what you said about the survival rate of Black women in these positions, whether or not, as you look back on your 8 years, it was worth it. And I also want to ask you, looking back on those 8 years, what you are proudest of, so you choose how you want to go at it.
I will take a combination, Travis, okay. For 500.
Take it.
I have no regrets. Absolutely no regrets, because I'm most proud of the fact that we have fundamentally changed the criminal justice system here in Cook County. We are the first state in the union to abolish cash bail, and that was work that we were a part of from the very beginning. We legalized marijuana here in Illinois, and not just that, we vacated the convictions of thousands of people who had convictions under amounts that are now legal, particularly, again, to Black communities who have been victims of the war on drugs. We stopped prosecuting people for driving on suspended licenses because they couldn't afford to pay tickets. Basically, we stopped criminalizing poverty. And when I think of truly the hundreds of men and women whose lives have been changed because of their wrongful convictions being vacated and the generational impact that it will have on their families, there's not a moment of regret. It has been incredibly hard. You know, I've gotten divorced in the course of the last 8 years. I've missed out on a lot with my children. And I've had to evaluate, you know, what does service look like? And history has shown me that service comes with sacrifice. And it has been truly an honor and a privilege to serve the people of Cook County, that the sacrifices that I've made, while painful, have been in service to something bigger than just me. And I could not be more privileged to have that.
Yeah, those sacrifices are as real as rain. You know, I always pray for my friends like you who are in positions like these, because I know the sacrifice that comes along with stepping up and offering yourself up as a public servant. I understand that. When we come forward in our remaining moments, I could have started our conversation here, but I will close with it. Many of us are concerned and paying attention to this shooting of Dexter Reed. Cornel West was a guest on this program the other day, making his announcement about his running mate, and he even raised the issue of Dexter Reed. So there are people who are obviously are paying attention to this and want to know a bit more about it, and I wonder what Kim Fox can tell me about it when we come forward in our remaining moments with her on Tavis Smiley.
For all the freedom-loving folk, this is Tavis Smiley.
I feel like freedom.
Let's get back to more of Tavis Smiley right now.
Got 4 minutes left here with Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox. She was talking earlier about group chats and the like. I was just texting the other day with my friend Father Michael Flager. Of course, we all know on the south side of Chicago, mm-hmm. St. Sabinas. He and I were texting the other day, and Dr. West was in the studio the other day, and we were talking about Dexter Reed Jr. This case, March 21, as I recall, almost 100 shots fired by cops in 41 seconds. The mayor, who's been a guest on this program of Chicago, lives on the west side. And I keep reading these stories about all these pretextual stops on the west side. And I don't know all the details of this, but it has become a national story. When you get shot at 100 times in 41 seconds by a number of cops, what can you tell me about the Dexter Reed Jr. case?
I can say that we are in the very early stages of our investigation. The Civilian Office of Police Accountability is leading that investigation. What you have said is correct, that this is an incident that happened as a result of Dexter Reed Jr. being pulled over for what was alleged to be a seatbelt violation that ended with the Chicago police officer shot and injured and Dexter Reed dead. So we are, looking at it to see if there are any criminal aspects for our office related to the shooting. It will take time. And certainly we're asking for people's patience as we go through this and seek justice in this case.
And what have you learned over 8 years that you are willing to share with me about police? And I don't want to cover that question any more than that. You're the state's attorney, and you're on both sides of this coin. But what have you learned about police?
I think we need our police to be legitimate and credible in order for us to have any meaningful chance to address violent crime in our communities. Communities that don't trust police will then take care of these situations themselves, what we would call street justice. And no one benefits from that. And that is because of a breakdown in the legitimacy of our institutions. We have in Chicago a consent decree that was entered after the murder of Laquan McDonald by mm-hmm. Jason Van Dyke. There's work that the Chicago Police Department needs to do to be in compliance with that. And that's not a Kim Fox proclamation. That's the Department of Justice said that there was unconstitutional, racially biased policing in Chicago. And it is my hope that there's an appreciation that the violence that we see in our communities is directly tied to the legitimacy of policing, so that there is an urgency to fix the institutions so that the people who need and rely upon it have the faith in its credibility.
I got 60 seconds left, so let me close by asking, so what's next, Kim Fox?
You could have had 20 seconds. I have no idea. We could have wrapped that up in five. I have no idea. I've been in public service for almost 30 years. I'm going to take a moment to rest, to reset my neurons. I've been in fight or flight for the last 8 years, and there's something calling me to rest. And so after I rest, I certainly want to still have impact, continue to make my people proud. And what that looks like, I'm waiting for the universe to tell me.
As the old folks say, you done good, Kim Fox. You done good. You done good. Honored to have had you on this program. Thank you for your work and your witness. Thank you for your service. Thank you for the many accomplishments. And thank you just for your story and for sharing your story. Your story is in and of itself inspiring to a lot of people. And for that, I celebrate you. Good to have you on. I'll talk to you somewhere down the road, I hope, Kim.
Indeed. Please. Anytime, Tavis. This has been a privilege.
Pleasure's all mine. Kim Fox, Cook County State's Attorney. More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward.